I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery. It's brought to you by our friends at useonlyasdirected.org. They got a three-part solution for the opioid epidemic. It's speak out, opt out, and of course, throw out. And we want to say thanks to them for helping this podcast keep going. Dr. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Would you say I'm woke?
You're woke?
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means.
You don't know what woke is?
That you're woke?
Yeah, so right now, if you're woke, that means that you're kind of hip to all things going on.
Oh, really?
And you understand the plight of the millennials.
You should learn something about me for a second.
Yeah.
I almost take pride in not knowing that kind of stuff anymore.
You're a therapist who talks to young kids.
Yeah, I haven't heard any kids use that hip lingo.
Okay, let's see. So
I'm unwoke to that.
Woke is a political term, refers to perceived awareness of issues concerning social justice, racial justice. It is derived from the African-American vernacular English, stay woke. And so, I mean, that's what everybody's saying right
so
now.
So it's more, but specifically about like political justice
And kind of all the stuff that's going on right now.
Right, okay. Well, I guess I'm not very woke.
I was talking to
Are you woke?
I don't know. I was at a lunch meeting the other day, and there's a 28-year-old guy there, and I thought, I'm gonna float this one by.
Okay.
And I was like, you know, I think I'm kind of woke. And he goes, excuse me? And I go, yeah, I think I'm kind of woke. And he goes, first off, you're too old to be using the term woke. And second, I don't think you are.
But was that how you started the conversation?
No. Okay. There was a whole conversation going on. And then, you know.
I like the idea of just you walking up to some 28-year-old guy and saying, I think I'm pretty woke.
But I don't know. But, you know, I mean, it's just, it's weird times right now.
I think the thing that people ought to do is educate themselves and pause and think and let themselves digest what's going on and be aware of your own perceptions of things and your own proclivities and have the understanding that we all have biases, and being aware of them is the first step in kind of moving forward. I think there's a lot of action going on, and I know there's a place for that. But within each of us personally, I think there's now's a good time for reflection and education.
You know, if I had a quarter for every time a teacher told me this, he goes, you know, Mr. Scott, you got one mouth and two ears. I go, yep. And they go, you should be listening twice as much as speaking.
Yeah, I bet you got that a lot.
a ton. But I think it's very apropos of right now. And I think we need to do a lot more listening than speaking. And we've talked about it on other podcasts that when everybody's speaking at the same time, which the world seems to be doing right now.
Oh, and we have so many outlets to all speak at the same time. Social media.
Nobody's listening. Everybody wants to prove that their opinion and their point is the right one. And nobody's saying that it's not, but nobody's listening.
Right.
And we just need to do a little more listening. And I thought we'd sit back and listen to Rob Eastman. We've had him on the podcast before. He's the tattooed life coach.
He's a good man to listen to.
And he was my workout partner all through the pandemic. He got me going. And the crazy thing is that his workout was different every day. And every time I walked in there, I would see the workout on the board. And I would say to myself, there's no way I'm going to do this. But by the end of it, I did do it, and I felt better about myself. And although I'm not working out with him right now, I still carry over a lot of his workouts into the gym. And I wanted to bring him on because this guy is just fascinating. We could have him on every day and talk about a different subject. But the subject I wanted to talk to you about today was there's a lot of good, and this podcast likes to focus on the hope that's going on in the recovery world. But there's a lot of bad too. And when I say bad, there's a lot of outcomes that ones that we don't wish for and wish they never happened. And the reality is that I remember when I was sitting down in my addiction, Dr. Matt, this guy goes, this is going to end two ways. And I'm like, okay. He goes, either you're going to fix it or you're going to die. And I said, well, what about? He goes, no, there's no what about. That's how this ends.
In that world, I agree.
You know, either you fix it or you die. And unfortunately, we've lost a lot of people to addiction, and you're surrounded by it. And how do you do that?
Man, I thought I was getting better at it. Just recently had a good friend of mine doing what I do. I've found that I have to set real clear boundaries with client friend. And I most of the time don't bring people into the friend zone. And this kid made it through. He was an amazing guy, Jason Vinberg. And we just got the call about 2 weeks ago that he had been shot, and it was due to some mental health things. And I imagine it's everywhere. You know, you have this idea of what your family's going to be like and look like, and you work really hard to keep your name good and all these things, and your son or your daughter or your dad or your husband or wife is out there acting a different way. And most of the times I feel like everything that everybody's fighting about right now is criminal injustice. Most of the time it's mental health issue. They're not thinking straight, or they're on drugs that they're using that to self-medicate. Like, if we put more money into mental health, I feel like a lot of this stuff would go away. If we put more money into elementary education on the way up and less into the prison systems, we wouldn't need the prison systems. So as I go through these things, one of the hardest, I've been to so many funerals that it's almost like not a big deal to me anymore, which is sad. But when I went and talked to his wife, to Jason's wife, and I went to try and explain to his 5-year-old and 11-year-old sons, trying to make sense of that, like, you and me both, we got a lot to say, right? And in that moment, trying to be the adult, trying not to cry, and seeing their faces, I lost it. I couldn't do it. I just told them I loved them. I hugged them. And what do you do to that? And I actually called Dr. Matt and ask for help. And I don't do that very often either. And that leaves untreated mental health, death, now leaves a sick family trying to put the pieces back together. Two boys that will never have their father again. And what do you do to that? We're not in the understanding anymore that the village raises the family. You don't tell my kid anything when so many families need the village. So as I go through this thing, I give my opinion probably a lot more than I should, but somebody's got to do it. These kids that I work with at the schools or this or that, they're not even close to a reality and what's real and what's not, what's coming down the pipeline. They feel they can do anything, act any way, and get away with it and all of these things. And I see myself in them, and I find it really hard not to say something. And shortly before that, we have a lot of overdose. Same thing, telling young girls, wives, moms, dads, that they're gone. And that's one of those calls parents and family members don't want to be the bad guy, or, you know, tell on the addict or get them the help they need in fear of backlash from the public or their church or whatever it is. And then it's too late. And then they're trying to pick up the pieces, the regret, the what if. And that's the side that nobody wants to see. And I'm not going to say anything bad about doctors, but a lot of doctors are out there prescribing the pills, but we don't see them at the funerals. They're nowhere to be found. It's like, if you see the aftermath, if you took the time to go and see what it does, what addiction does to families, what untreated mental health does to families, like, we got some work to do. All of us. If you're recovered from mental health, if you have your life in order, you need to go out and share your story. I think that's part of the calling. Once you've been through something hard, whether that be being molested, trauma, bad relationship, whatever it is, don't hide that. Those are the pieces we need in society to help us get better. And I don't know how else to say that. But,
well, I think it breaks a shame cycle, right? And what the two of you do by going out and telling your stories of recovery, that has started to become more accepted. Like, this conversation, just literally since you've gotten sober, just in the last 10 years, is a more common conversation about drug, alcohol, abuse, addiction. How do we recover? Now we have so many. Even when I was in graduate school 20 years ago, the main recovery method was just a 12-step type program. And now we see that we know that one program doesn't fit for everybody. And so there are so many options. But I agree with you. In other areas, mental health is often behind the reason a person has an addiction. And so having education creates prevention, and we can prevent so many of these problems either from occurring at all or to the severity that they might occur otherwise. But not if you get recovered, however you want to say that, and then you keep it to yourself, you're probably still holding on to some shame. You need to get out and talk about it and be willing to share your voice, because there's somebody else around you that's going through just what you went through.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Is if you don't dare share your story, you're definitely holding on to shame.
Yeah, yeah.
And addiction thrives in shame. Yeah. You know, people ask me all the time, Casey, do you believe in miracles? And I answer yes every single time. And I think you would say the same thing, because, Rob, you have danced with death twice, and you're here to tell us about it. Tell me about those two times.
Man, there's a lot more that I made it through, but these two specific was, I was at a friend of mine's funeral from an overdose, and I needed to get really high in order to go there, so I didn't feel all of those things. I didn't feel ashamed. I didn't feel bad. I didn't, you know, I felt like, because we used together, I had a part in that. And I remember walking into the funeral home up in Farmington and seeing the family, and it was like God reached down and removed all of the numbing, all of the drugs out of my system, and he made me feel everything. And at that time was like, okay, I got to change my life. I gotta do something here. So again, we didn't really talk about rehabs, and only knew maybe one or two people in my whole circle that had ever even gone. So I just started calling, and this is back when we didn't have internet on our phones, so we had to make phone calls. And I got accepted in, and this is like at the funeral Sunday night, and they have a bed on Wednesday. But anybody that uses drugs knows that if you quit doing drugs for a few days, you're going to get sick, and pretty good chance I wasn't going to make it to rehab. So I went down to my shop, and I had just bought a bunch of drugs, and I knew that I didn't want to get sick. So I got rid of all my needles and coke and heroin and everything, threw it away, but I kept some, and I shot up one more time so that I wouldn't get sick the next day and that I could make it to detox and that I would go. And that's all I remember. And the kid that was with me said that I walked out of the bathroom and I had a convulsion, and I threw myself back onto my head, hit my head, and he came to check on me, and I had blood coming out of my mouth, out of both ears and out of both nostrils. And he checked to see if I was breathing. I wasn't. And I think like most addicts in that situation, rather than calling 911, you're going to bail because you don't want to get in trouble. And he left. And a few minutes later down the road, he called 911 and told them what happened. They came and kicked in the door, and they worked on me for 25 minutes to get me back, get my heart pumping. And spent 10 days in a coma in ICU up at the U. And when I came out of that, you know, I had a lot of friends, right? I had the house. I had all the big parties. And you'd figure 10 days in the hospital, all my buddies would be there when I woke up, and I woke up to an empty room. My mom and my sister were sitting there. And that entire time, not one person came to see me. And that was the time I found it. Like, I couldn't feel any more lonely than that. And you'd think after I flatlined three times, right? So knowing all of these things, and the first words out of the doctor's mouth to me when I woke up was, your liver's functioning at 13%. You're going to need a liver transplant, all of these things. And I'm just like, I don't care. And while you're in there, they're feeding you drugs to kill the pain, but it wasn't the drugs I was withdrawing from. So the whole time I was in there, I'm lying to the doctor about how good I am, because all I can think about is getting high again. And that's the part that people don't see. I don't want to hurt anybody. I'm hurting, and I want that to go away. And I didn't dare kill myself. So the only other option was drugs and alcohol. So I got out of ICU, and I had a girl come pick me up, and she drove me straight to my drug dealer's house. That was the first thing I did out of ICU.
Crazy.
And that is probably pretty common, in the sense that most people, like, we don't mean to hurt our family members. We don't mean to ruin marriages. We just don't know. We feel the pain, and I'm not justifying it by any means. It is not. It is unacceptable. But if we look at the other side of that, is, you know, I thought about killing myself the first time in the third grade. I had ADHD. I got made fun of by my teachers in class because I couldn't sit still like everybody else. I had to take a pill, and nobody else. Everybody laughed at me when she asked me to take my pill. So they must not have to take a pill. You know, all you want to do is when you're a little kid is fit in. And that's when it started for me. And then after that, I got clean and everything was going great. And I'm 18 months clean and sober after that. And I met this beautiful woman, and she was LDS. That's what my family always wanted for me. And things were great. We end up getting married in the temple. Never in a million years did I think that would happen. And so we get going, and I start doing all the things that I loved before. I wasn't quite aware of the fact. Now I'm sober. My life's back on track, right? I didn't understand all the other things like preventing injury, you know, not feeling pain, and because I was doing good. So I was playing soccer, and I blew my ACL, and I went into surgery. And when I came out, I'm married at this time, just built a nice big home down in North Salt Lake, and my wife stayed home. She was working, and she stayed home to make sure that I was okay. And, you know, the nerve block, if anybody's ever had a surgery, the nerve block works pretty good. And so she went back to work, and the next day the nerve block wore off. And I'd been clean for 18 months, but the feeling of that pain, I hadn't set. I'd made all my relationships great, but the relationship with pain was still directly tied to drugs. So after 18 months, I called my drug dealer. He still had the same number, and I had a needle in my arm within an hour of that nerve block wearing off.
And it went from bad to worse after that.
Yeah, and then find out I'm going to be a father. My daughter's born. We'll just fast forward through all that drama. And it came to the point where she was 7 months old. My wife left because I couldn't take care of myself or anybody else. And I knew that my daughter deserved better. And that meant me finally taking my life. That she wasn't old enough to ever know me. I wouldn't embarrass her. I wouldn't ruin her life like I had everybody else that I come across. So I found myself up above the Bountiful Temple, sessions on the benches with a gun in my mouth. And knelt down and started to pull the trigger, and had this kind of thought of my daughter and my mom. And I knew that my daughter, I'd played that one. They give you the pros and cons list in rehab, yeah. Right? Well, what would happen? What could happen? I'm like, yeah, she's going to be, any man on this planet could be a better father than me. So that went away. And then my mom, being a very God-loving woman, and at that point I hated God, and he'd never answered any of my prayers. And I made a deal with myself. I'd say one more prayer so that when he didn't answer that prayer, that when my mom died, she could go look him in his face and say, you failed me. It was a nice, spiteful little note to God. And said a prayer about not knowing anything about a still small voice. I'm going to need something a little bit louder than that. And if I open my eyes before I get that, then I'm pulling the trigger. And that was August 31st, 2009. And right as I went to open my eyes, I'm pulling the trigger. A firework display went off above the Bountiful Temple. And a few seconds after that, I heard a voice, and it said, is that loud enough? And I was paralyzed. I was laying there crying my eyes out, face first in the dirt. And I feel my Savior gave me enough to know that I needed to move forward. And that's the next day when I started my sobriety date, and I've never looked back.
And you've got 10 years, 10 months under your belt right now.
Yep.
Congratulations, man.
And for all the people out there listening, I hated God. Didn't believe in religion. Like, these are not little stories to tell. It was something that I don't even know how to explain it, but that's a miracle for me. And to be here today sharing my story is a miracle. And hopefully it'll help somebody else change their mind.
And I've seen the way your daughter looks at you.
Yeah, I can't imagine not being in her life.
You're a good dad.
I appreciate that. It's such a fake thing when you're down in the dirt and you're in that dark place, you feel you're not worthy of love, that how could anybody love you? You hate yourself. And that is the biggest lie of all. No matter what you've done, you can always work through it if you're willing to do the work.
And that's the most important part. Some hope. If you're willing to do the work.
Yeah, talk about that. You said your relationship with pain. That really struck me. Like, expand on that a little bit. Like, what is your relationship with pain like today? Because you obviously still have pain. Everybody does.
Yeah. It is my greatest respected coach, if you will. I love it. Not in the sense that I go look for it, but it lets me know that I'm alive, and it lets me know that, and it depends on what sense we're doing it in, but it definitely, I think a lot more before I do something. Like if you look at my Instagram, things like that, you'll see skydiving and rock climbing and fighting and all of these things. But, it's helped me face a lot of fears and come to, you got to respect pain.
Pain's an amazing teacher.
Yeah. I don't want to run from it, but I don't want to sit in it either.
And that's what I was hoping you would talk about, is that how we perceive things, our perception of things, influences how we feel and what we do. If our perception is I can't handle pain, then we're going to feel afraid and we're going to run away and do something probably damaging to mask that pain.
Yeah. And that can be physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain.
Sure.
And I ran from all of them. I didn't like any of it at all. And now I know if I'm feeling spiritual pain, it's probably because I just lied or I just mistreated somebody. And that's a great tell for me to stop where I'm at and go and fix that before it grows into a whole bed. Speaking of gardening, a whole bed of weeds, because it does grow and it rots. And the emotional pain, being mistreated, staying in a bad relationship that you know you don't belong in, knowing that you're better than the way you're being treated, mistreating others, like all of those things. I don't like feeling that. And if I feel that way, they probably feel that same way, and I can do something about it. I can't ask them to do anything, but I can move forward. And then physical pain allows me, in the sense that I'm talking of hitting the gym hard, getting stronger. That's part of the reward, is the pain. And
so you've reconceptualized what pain means in your life.
Absolutely.
From that moment you got out, you know, when that block wore off, pain meant something very different. And
Absolutely.
Now your perception, or, you know, we would say reframed what that means. And now it's something that motivates you.
Yeah.
One of the things that I talk about in therapy a lot is resistance promotes growth. And I feel like that's a basic law of nature. If you look at how anything grows on the planet in any way, spiritual, physical, emotional, resistance is part of that. And resistance is another word for pain, that we have to go through difficult things. But if we go through them, that's how we grow and become better people.
Yeah. I can't remember the exact wording on the story of the seed. Said the tiny little seed knew that it had to be submerged in darkness in order to grow. And that really hit me back in the day. And I'm a big warrior mentality, samurai style thing. My podcast is called Stand and Fight, but I saw this saying, it says it's better to stand and fight. If you run, you will only die tired. And to me, that meant I needed to stand up against my mental health, against my anxiety, against my depression, against my suicide, and learn to fight, which meant me training in the gym, becoming physically healthy and mentally healthy so that I could handle anything that came my way.
Another favorite Rob quote that I love is, it's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war.
Yeah, be
like
prepared.
Be prepared. And that's what he does at his gym and the tattooedlifecoach.com. So thank you very much for stopping by and sharing your story again. It's always a pleasure to check in with you. I mean, I could sit and listen to your stories all day long.
Oh, he's a great guy to talk to.
Appreciate you guys.
I feel like one of the things I like about talking with Rob is he's kind of one of those inspirational guys. You do remind me of other people I've known growing up who, when you talk to them, you kind of want to do better.
It's like that feeling when you watched your very first Rocky movie.
Yes.
You walk out of there and you're like, I can do that.
And you'll punch some meat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rob's a living Rocky movie.
Oh, I would agree with that. Absolutely.
Hey, thank you to useonlyasdirected.org for their three-part solution: speak out, opt out, and throw out. Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
The contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.